Hi, everyone. It's Dr. Denise, and this is the Dr. Denise Show. This is the Embrace Your Neurostyle series, and I am truly honored. I have Gabe Howard here today. Gabe is an award-winning writer and speaker. He lives with bipolar disorder. He has an award-winning podcast, Inside Mental Health, and I just love the name of his book, Mental Illness is an Asshole and Other Observations. Gabe, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you.
Thank you. So, you know, I know that you have a podcast and you also do a co-host podcast with Michelle Hammer. And so I just want to like dive into almost like the passion of having your own voice when you want to get messages out. Can you just talk a little bit about your medium and the way you're getting your voice heard to the world?
It's you know, I always like to talk. I remember a long, long time ago when I told my grandmother that I wanted to be a mental health speaker. And she said, "What's a mental health speaker?" And I said, "Well, it's somebody who gets paid to talk." And she said, "Oh, you're going to be rich." And
oh, my goodness. How old were you when you told your grandma that?
Oh, this would have been 12, 13 years ago. So I would have been 32.
Oh my goodness. I love it.
So young.
I love it, but it's so good when you just sort of declare, you know, when we are trying to have our voice in the world, it's almost like we hold a flag and we're just putting a stake into the ground and saying, here I am. And so I just want you to know my process of getting ready to meet someone like you is really exciting. I always light a candle. I have my coffee here. I try to do a little bit of background, but not too much because it's like exciting. It's like I'm getting to know you and everyone else is getting to know you. So can you just take us on your journey of your mental health advocacy wherever you want to start? Because I love hearing the inspiration and the evolution.
I knew nothing at all about mental health, and neither did my family. You know, mental illness was something that happened to other families. And we believed all of the stereotypes. My family was the walking definition of stigma. We believe that mental illness came from like abusive parents or alcoholism or something went wrong. Somebody did something that they shouldn't be doing. And the natural outcome was mental illness. We simply did not know. That's the first thing that I want to point out. The second thing that I want to point out is...
I want to honor that because I've spoken in India, bridging East and Western, kind of nurturing children's mental health. And step one of mental, physical, and spiritual well-being is awareness. So I love that you just said we did not know. So sometimes when we're judging people, whether it's about mental health, sexuality, gender, politics, you know, we only know what we know. So keep going.
Yeah, I really like how you said that. We only know what we know. And specifically, we only know what we've been taught or exposed to or had reason to understand. And this is a very important part of my story. I thought about suicide as far back as I can remember. From the day I was born, I had fantasies or considerations of ending my life at 5 years old. At 6 years old, at 10 years old, at 12 years old, it was just ever present. And that's the thing about something that's ever present, right? You don't realize that it's wrong. I just thought it was part of the human condition. When I looked at all of the other people around me, I thought that they were having the same thoughts and feelings that I was. And
you know what? That's so interesting that you say that. First of all, I put my hand on my heart when I sort of travel back in time with you as a young child, because you're used to telling your story, but people that have never experienced feeling suicidal, even that word for some people is unimaginable. And one of the things I'm passionate about, Gabe, is perception. And you're talking about a perception at that young age. And the word neurostyle I've defined as we all process and perceive things in our own unique way with the fabulous five: biological, psychological, social, cultural, spiritual, and then sixth sense, intuition. So keep going, because that's a big aha moment for all of us, that awareness of perception. And when we start to perceive feelings, thoughts, and then acting on it.
And let's talk about that perception, right? My perception was that thinking about ending your life was normal. And my parents' perception was that this wasn't a problem because they were good parents. And my story doesn't like zag to the left. I'm not about to tell you how my parents beat me or how none of that happened. They were good people who worked hard and took care of us, and they were supportive. Listen, we weren't Leave It to Beaver, but we were a good family. And
yes, you were. You were Leave It to Beaver. I'm saying,
trust me, we were not Leave It to Beaver unless the Cleavers started swearing and yelling a whole lot.
Oh my goodness. So just so you know, the fact that you have profanity in your book title, I did a really fun show that was only like 11 minutes. Like this is like 3 years ago now, called The Strategic F-Bomb. And then I even made an asset off to send it to you called Mindful Profanity. So I think profanity, though, that even has been perceived. Like if you're swearing at someone and being intentionally mean versus using profanity in almost like a healing way, you know what I'm saying? We can judge all kinds of words, thoughts, and actions when we get right down to it, right?
Exactly. I have been a firm believer my entire life that we should be judging context, not words. I don't like this idea of bad words. I would much prefer that we move into bad context, because if we vilify the words, we let the context escape. And we see this all the time. We've come up with such clever ways to be misogynistic and racist, but because we're not using the words, the context can just carry on.
Well, it's the same thing. If you and I were to take one sentence out of this show, but not have the intentionality around it, I think that's a big discussion. I talk on my other show on my other series on staying sane is mindful ingestion. And so the reason why I came up with the word neurostyle, that we all process and perceive things in our own unique way, it's a multidimensional contextual definition. So you're Gabe, I'm Denise, right? And then we have our own perception. We have our own biological makeups. You know, some people have mental health formal diagnoses. Some people have neurostyles. We all have a neurostyle. You know, whether you're diagnosed with something with mental health or not, we have traits. We have qualitative feelings. So it seems like you and I are on the same page with the importance of like a holistic contextual perception definition.
I really just want people to understand that the way that we experience the world is different for any number of reasons. We're starting to understand that the way that people experience the world is different based on their culture. And that's great. The way that people experience the world is different based on their gender, based on their sexuality, based on their socioeconomic status. But I really, when it comes to mental illness, we have to drill it really, really, really far down, that sometimes the way that people perceive the world has a lot more to do with their illness or disorder or trauma than we realize. And the problem with being somebody like me who lives with bipolar disorder is obviously the way that I see the world is through this bipolar lens. And when I was sick and had no treatment and no understanding, extraordinarily symptomatic, everything that I did had to go through this bipolar filter, this disordered filter, but nobody around me knew it. So they just judged me like every other 10, 12, 15, 20 year old. And all of a sudden, symptoms of bipolar disorder were behavioral problems. They were, you're a bad person. They were character flaws. And because I was being judged on the identical level as everybody else my age, I failed at every point. And instead of somebody realizing, hey, there might be something wrong here, the thing that they thought was wrong was that I was a bad person. Well, eventually I started to believe them. You can only be called bad so many times before you just think you're bad. I thought I was bad. I thought I was a bad person.
You know, I just want to say that I thought I was a bad person. And what my experience, not only as a mother, as an adult and child integrative psychiatrist, you know, Gabe, I adopted my son at birth, and he is a force to be reckoned with. And I know the birth family's history on the mother's side, and there's two generations of suicide completion. And I knew a lot of the different risk factors going into being an adoptive mom. but my son's thriving on my watch. But this whole thing about, I thought I was a bad person. You know, he used to think I'm stupid, mom, every time I would drop him off at public school. Not that the public schools here aren't fantastic in Manhattan Beach, but a lot of public schools and a lot of workplaces don't understand educational challenge, mental illness, you know, gender inequality. We're getting better at it. You know, we're getting more aware, but that I thought I was a bad person, so profound. Until someone gets in the right set of circumstances where they have their awareness about their neurostyle. If, you know, let me hear about your, when you started to shift away from thinking you were a bad person and when you were more aware of what was actually going on. What was that journey like for you?
So I was admitted to a psychiatric hospital. That is the start of recovery or stability or whatever word you want to put on it. I woke up in a psychiatric hospital, and in the psychiatric hospital, I was 28,
okay.
28 years old. I was admitted to a psychiatric hospital and I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. Now,
so that took a long time, because if you were having thoughts of wanting to leave the planet since age 5, you know, and we know that 50% of all lifelong mental health challenges happen before age 12, and then 75% before age 23, 24, you were 28 when you were hospitalized. I think that's one of the other big challenges for humanity. So keep telling your story, but don't you agree that there's a lot of myth busting that we still need to do to get people help sooner?
There's just a ton of myth busting that we need to do. Nobody was ever going to think that I had mental illness in my circle, my sphere of influence, my family, because we believed one thing above all others. People with mental illness came from bad families, probably the mom. Like I said, this was a value in our family.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in central Ohio.
By the way, I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Schaumburg, Illinois. So I'm a Midwestern too. So keep going.
Yeah.
My grandpa, when he heard I was going into psychiatry, he's like, oh, and you're in California? That's where all the nuts are. So I mean,
wow. I mean, but this stuff persists, right?
Yes, it does.
I love my family, and they always come off bad in this section, and I feel bad, but you know, the truth is the truth.
But what they don't know, they don't know. Correct.
Exactly. What they don't know, they don't know. And because we were stereotypically blue collar, my father believed that anything that befell a man could be resolved by rubbing mud on it. We didn't talk a lot about our emotions. I've seen my father cry one time, and that was at my grandfather's funeral. And even then, he was doing everything he could not to cry. And this is just our way. It's not right. It's not wrong. It just is. So since we believed that mental illness only came from essentially trauma, bad parenting, you know, beatings, alcoholism, sexual abuse, et cetera. And since none of that was going on, and I want to be very clear, none of that was going on, there would be no reason to believe that my behavior had anything to do with mental illness and just had everything to do with making bad choices. And the people around me responded in kind. And I want to be a little fair here. People are like, oh my God, they saw the symptoms of bipolar disorder and they ostracized you. They thought you were a bad person. Why would they do that? Okay, let's take a
look.
They
didn't know.
They didn't know.
They didn't know.
But look at what they saw. Here's what they saw. Gabe, in 2 weeks, can you help me move? Absolutely, in 2 weeks, I can help you move. Then we get to that day. I'm seriously depressed. I won't leave the house. I won't answer the phone. They're counting on me. They're calling. Gabe, where are you? Gabe, we need your help. Gabe, the truck is here. Gabe, we're not going to be able to get this done before the truck. And I don't call them back for 3 weeks. Okay, So you're right. They should absolutely think that that's mental illness, well, not just thinking, a guy who's trying to get out of.
Can we just throw out some terms, you and I, if we were playing like wordsmithing? Yeah. I mean, let's just take this outside of Gabe. Anyone who says they're going to do something, doesn't do it and doesn't follow through, you start to get this dialogue. They're lazy. They don't care. They're selfish, right?
Right.
These are the perceptions.
Yes. Yeah. And those are very easy perceptions to come up with because they don't know. Correct. It's not like I called them up and canceled at the last minute. That would be problematic enough. But now let's go the other way, right? Let's go the other way where I do answer the phone because I'm manic. And in this situation, I'm manic. So that Saturday comes around, I've been up for 2 days and I'm like, Gabe, you promised to help me move. Oh, moving stupid. I love your apartment. You don't need to move. Gabe, you promise. Nah, you know, I'll be around. I'll be there. Don't worry about it. Don't. Why you want out of that apartment anyway? That's a good, you know, I never liked the house. And they're just like, what the hell? What, mm-hmm. You not only did you promise, but now you're just randomly saying vaguely insulting things. And so, yeah, they didn't, after a while, they just, if you can't rely on somebody, you stop calling. If people don't show up, you stop inviting. Eventually you move on with your life, especially as you become an adult. Maybe you're willing to tolerate that when you're 15, 16, 20, 22, maybe. I don't know. But remember, I was 28. People weren't tolerating this anymore. People were done. People were just done. My first wife left me. I was all alone in the world. And everybody had moved on. You know, they had kids now. I started to let down people's children. You know, will you come to little Bobby's first birthday? I will absolutely be there to celebrate your first child's first birthday. And then I didn't show up. And then it's like, you know what? You know, it's bad enough that you've been this way to me, but they really saw it as me putting their child in a bad place. Like I rejected their child. So
can I ask you a question when I'm hearing this?
Yeah,
did you have any internal awareness of your emotional state of depression, or how were you in those moments before you got the help perceiving yourself? Was there shame, no shame? Were you afraid to express your feelings?
So therein lies the problem. Bipolar disorder is very much a spectrum. And on one end of the spectrum, I thought that I was garbage and needed to die and that nobody would miss me. So in those moments, I felt shame and loneliness and just every negative thing that you can think, I felt about myself. I thought I was a garbage person. So that's not really good awareness, right? Because thinking that if you died, your mother and grandmother would be happy is not firing on all cylinders. Then let's go over to the other side, mania. When all these people would be mad at me, I was like, why are they trying to bring me down? Why are they trying to steal my happiness? I'm just trying to live my best life. I would get so angry at them for being mean to me. And the mania would help sell it. You're thinking to yourself, well, but you know you stood them up, right? No. The mania makes sure that I forget that detail. The mania focuses on them calling me up and saying, you promised, you know, you're an asshole, Gabe, and hanging up on me. And the mania would keep me focused on that negative interaction. Well, why'd they yell at you? Why'd they call you a name? They had no right to do that. And because I've removed all of the other context, I got to win. I convinced myself that for no reason, they just called up and yelled at me. Well, no self-awareness there. Now, sometimes I'd be in the middle, right? That's the problem with the spectrum. You can be right in the middle, normal, stereotypical, average, full control of your faculties, not encumbered by depression or mania, just really thinking. And there's another problem. You tend to forget the things that happen when you're depressed or manic. You remember bits and pieces, but then you call up and you're like, hey, do you want to hang out? And now there's no emotion on their part. So they're just like, yeah, maybe I'll give you a ring. And you're not sure why they're putting you off. Maybe they're putting you off because they're really busy. That's reasonable. Maybe they're putting you off because they have children's jobs, girlfriends, wives, boyfriends, husbands, whatever. Or as I found out later, yeah, they were just tired. They were just tired of me. They were done. But I couldn't really put all that together because everything is coming in clips and phrases and it's missing core components. So to have actual awareness, you need to see things through. Just in order to have actual awareness, you need to see things as they actually are. No filters,
that's
no
actually
good,
really
no bad.
Tricky though. I'm listening to you from a philosophical standpoint. Like I'm listening to you as Gabe, that I'm flying over it, listening to it as a producer and like also a doc, like I'm trying to the best that I can listen to your words through the perception of what you're saying. But that also goes back to, we all process and perceive things in our own unique way. And as much as we know our own biases, and how can we really be in the moment of now? And when you were discussing your depressed version of your mood state versus your manic perception of your mood state, when now you just brought it back to perception. So how does someone be in a grounded level of awareness and actually, I'm going to use your words, actually see things as they are? I almost feel like there would be, like you and I, since we're just meeting for the first time today, can you imagine if we did a fun workbook where we were having like a think tank where you're like, dun, 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 Dr. Denise and Gabe, dun, 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 what to ask a person when they're depressed versus manic, to get them more in an awareness. Because it's not easy, right? When you're in that manic state, when people are asking you things, you even said, you don't even know why they were mad at you. You're like, what? Right? I mean, isn't this the trickiest like million-dollar question that you're asking?
I think this is, there's two really, really big problems when it comes to treating disorders. I'm sorry. There are two really big problems when it comes to treating bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. And one is that it's not a disorder at all. And with therapy and coping skills, you can manage it on your own. I don't know why this persists, but people believe that you can just will yourself out of this illness. The second big myth that persists is that therapy support groups are unnecessary and you don't need them. And you just need a purely pharmaceutical solution and you will be fine. For some reason, those two things, instead of being combined like they should be, are almost mutually exclusive. Are you treating your bipolar disorder with medication, or are you treating your bipolar disorder with therapy? You need to treat your bipolar disorder with both. I know that it is not a popular thing in some circles, but
oh, it isn't. I mean, all my circles like run this way. I mean, I'm an adult and child integrative psychiatrist, but most people I know that have bipolar know that they need both. Where is it not championed? Can you explain? I really want to know this. It's kind of like when people go to AA and then some people are like, AA is not for me, but I'm still sober, right? So there's different almost like think tank groups. Where are these? Like, do you get backlash for this?
I get so much backlash for this. People tell me all the time, you're in the pocket of big pharma. You're just pushing medications on people and they don't need it. Any type of divergent thinking, big pharma just wants to shove pills and change who you are. People with bipolar disorder don't need medication. They're forced to take it so that people can profit off of them.
I'm so glad. Wait, I'm just going to do a mindful pause because Gabe, I've decided to stay and continuing practicing as an MD, even though I have other ways I want to serve the world. But I will tell you that after 21 years of being an adult and child psychiatrist, I always try to use the least amount of medicines. I do holistic health, nutrition, fitness, sleep, people's spiritual approach. There's even seasons with different diagnoses that my patients have, like maybe the winter season, they need this combination of meds. Some people can get off meds. So I have this is just you knowing me for the first time. I have this reputation of the doctor who doesn't just grab the prescription pad, but there are times when that prescription pad is life-saving. It is absolutely. So I really haven't been meeting with pharmaceutical reps. One, because I'm a mother and I'm very busy, but two, I try to just read the scientific data and just, you know what I'm saying? I try not to be like owned by any sort of institution, but I just want to let you know a little bit about the way I practice psychiatry. And also now I want to keep hearing your fight, because that's like really makes me sad, because I know so many people that even struggled with their own diagnoses of bipolar. And when they're stable and that they're on the right combination of meds, some people, you know, usually if you have very severe, there's different levels and types of bipolar. There's the more manic, there's the more depressed. And there are some people that have hypomania. And I know you know all this, but I'm just saying some people have different combinations of meds during different seasons of their life. And I always try to, if it's not a severe enough diagnosis of any type and someone can get off meds, that is the goal or the least amount. But if someone needs them and you're being told that you're like the big pharma boy, that would be insulting to me. I would be very upset. And I just want to like validate like you in this process of what you're trying to do to help others. Thank you so much.
It's fascinating to me because I understand, I completely understand why people don't like medications. That is a reasonable thing to, it's so reasonable. Yes. Not to like medications. I don't know.
And by the way, I feel I'm an MD, just so you know. Mythbuster is that, oh, every psychiatrist, they picture me like dun, dun, dun at the front door, like with a smile in the office, like ready to throw pills at someone. It's the exact opposite. In fact, I've had someone say to me, you will prescribe if you need to, right? And I said, of course I will. And then I was like, Gabe, I was like, kind of glad that I have that reputation. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I'm like, but of course I would. And so everyone, if you go to my website, you get it. Like, I want it all. I want all the tools in the toolbox. Why not have an open mind to all the tools in the toolbox with the most amount of health, the least amount of mental illness, and the most amount of success, right?
Exactly. And I understand why the medication gets a bad rap. It's traumatizing, right? It's traumatized, especially the young ages. You know, you're 22 years old and you're carrying around a pillbox like your grandma. That means something. That feels a certain way. I understand why people don't like this. And then the side effects. The side effects are they're brutal and they can be brutal. And then the time, you're young. So we have almost zero experience with the medical community anyway. So you're 22 years old, you're put on medication, it doesn't work. And I now know at 45 that just means try again, use that data that you gained to dial it in, maybe add a medication, maybe raise the dose, maybe lower a dose. But remember, we're dealing with one, sick people, and two, young people. So there's like, the pills don't work. I have treatment resistant bipolar or whatever, because they don't understand. And unfortunately, because of managed care and money, nobody has time to explain this to them. So they just quit. They give up, or they have a side effect, like a sexual side effect or weight gain. And they're just like, you know what? I'm done. The problem there is that's the worst way to handle this. It's absolutely the worst way to handle this. It shouldn't be, I'm done with medication. It should be, I'm done with that medication. And we just don't see that enough. We see people freaking out.
So one thing I just want to just do a mindful honoring of your words is I think a lot of people also, we have a shortage of mental health providers. There's a shortage of, I'm an adult and child psychiatrist. There's a shortage of child psychiatrists. I believe that all adult psychiatrists should have child training. I don't think it should be separate, because if I would have just stopped at adult psychiatry alone, I would not understand all the different degradations of the autism spectrum, bipolar spectrum, the ADD to the level that I do because of this quality of, you know, meeting people. Also, I think it's really important, Gabe, when you're talking, when someone's talking to their MD, if you are needing the medication, having enough time. Sometimes this is why I work in private practice. If I worked at a clinic, they might only give me a very short amount of time to hear what I just had that this week. Someone's thriving now with their major depression and anxiety, but they're having more sexual side effects. And then, but they're like, oh my goodness, I just don't want to be depressed. So for the next month, we're going to stabilize with that medicine. Then in 1 month, we're going to change to another one that might have less sexual side effects. Cause they're like, wow, I just do not want to be depressed. I'm okay with not having as much sex this month. We'll tackle it, but to talk with your doctor or clinician, in a way where you really trust them. Don't you find that that's like key, that therapeutic alliance of getting the right diagnoses and then working with the right team?
That is everything that you just said is really spot on, but I want to move it just slightly over to the left a little. Mm-hmm. Having that sex conversation, let's keep it right on sex, right?
Yeah,
there.
Let's do it. Let's talk so, sex.
Right. So I'm 22 years old, right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with a male. I'm a 22-year-old man, and I'm going to pretend that you are my mother's age. Because you remember, my mom would be like 45, right? So You're a 45-year-old woman. I'm a 22-year-old man. I'm unmarried. And, you know, my mom brought me because I'm still on her insurance. And I know that the reason that I want to stop taking this medication is because I can't have sex. Now, my mom's sitting in the waiting room. It's going to be on her insurance. And you look me right in the eye, my mom's age, my mom's peer, my mom's contemporary. I'm really young and not to mention sick. And now I can't get an erection. And you say, hey, do you have any problems?
Right.
No, I'm good. And now let's make this even worse. The reality is I have learned that actually most 22-year-old boys or men, young adults, are in fact willing to tell a doctor who is 45 years old and looks like their mother. And there's a lot of male doctors out there and they're more than willing to tell them. So let's flip the gender a little bit. Mm-hmm. Now you are a 22-year-old female. You've got a 45-year-old doctor who looks like your dad. And you're unmarried and in school and you want to talk about sex and something horrific happens. And I hear this time and time and time again. The 22-year-old woman works up the courage and says, I can't have sex. Doctor looks her right in the eyes and say, are you married? What is that? I just told you that I can't. Well, why? Does it matter? And they, this judgment comes in, and we've heard horror stories in our community about the doctor telling the parents that the child, and I know 22 is not a child, but there's still that dynamic, especially if you're still on your parents' insurance, which let's face it, since most people get their insurance through either their parents or their employer, if you're 18, 20, 22 years old, chances are you haven't landed the kind of employment, especially if you're sick, that's going to get you really robust insurance. So you're probably being helped out or still on your parents' insurance. So the doctor comes out and says, well, you know, your daughter's sexually active. Mom freaks out. Why are you doing that? We thought we raised you better. And maybe your mom wouldn't do that because many families just don't even talk about sex. Maybe your mom would be super cool about it. Maybe your dad would be super cool about it. But everybody's heard this story so often that the minute they're sitting in that room as a 20, 22-year-old woman or a 16-year-old girl or an 18-year-old woman, and the doctor says, is there any problem? It's a man. Looks like your dad. Nope. You're done. Because you know that the fallout could be, I'm not saying it's a guarantee. I'm not trying to throw all doctors under the bus. We've just heard the horror story so many times, especially for young women, that they're just unwilling to risk it. And this impacts their care in so many ways.
So what you just spoke about, I love that the sexual side effects are the ones that we're going ding, 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 because we're really talking about therapeutic trust, therapeutic alliance, and how to find a clinician, an MD, and a therapist that's non-shaming, whether it's about sexuality, gender, lifestyle habits. I even, you know, my patients know that I'm not, if they tell me, like one of my patients, like, oh, Dr. McDermott, I am still socially drinking and I have mood issues. They know that I'm not going to shame them because they all want to tell me the truth. I'm like, okay, so let's look at that. What's your mood state when you're not using substances versus when you are? Instead of like making someone feel like they have to go in the prison shame room because they were honest with me, right? You know, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. That there needs to be this give and take. There needs to be this understanding of privacy, of a safe space.
Yes.
Of listen, even if you, I hate to say even if you're doing the wrong thing, because that's not what we mean. Just even if you're doing not the best choice, right?
Correct.
You need to know that.
Correct.
And listen to all of our listeners like, well, why? Why does the doctor need to know that? I'll tell you why. Because if I stop taking this medication because I'm having a sexual side effect, but I don't tell the doctor that I stopped taking the medication, the doctor assumes that I'm still on the medication. That's number one. Number two, as the doctor is trying to prescribe different medications to help me, the doctor is like, well, this is fantastic. I prescribed Gabe class A. Class A had no side effects. There are other medications in class A that I can help bolster his. So you keep yes. prescribing me class A. Well, class A causes me sexual side effects. Now, listen, it's not quite that simple. I'm really, really, really making it sound super easy. And it's not. You got to go to medical school to understand this. But the data is now flawed. The doctor believes that I have become yes. unstable on a medication, but I didn't become unstable on a medication. I'm unstable because I'm not taking a medication. doctor now has a bad data point, and therefore every decision the doctor makes is based on that bad data point. And then unfortunately, many, many patients, they say, well, medication didn't work for me. Well, it didn't help. Welp, it just made it worse. Welp, it gave me side effects. But in actuality, the thing that went wrong is they weren't communicating with their doctor for so many reasons that lie both at the feet of the patient and, unfortunately, of the doctor. It's a really big social problem.
So Gabe, I feel like from this time that we've spent right now on this show, we've really talked about the importance of awareness, perception, communication, creating a non-shaming and a therapeutic environment, and building trust as the elements that kind of catapult from someone going from crisis to their stabilization, then hopefully to thrive. And I don't know how much time you have to talk today. What's your time situation like today?
I have about 20 more minutes.
Okay. So you and I can do, I feel like we're at such a crucial point. In this next part of this interview, can you take people on your crisis to thrive journey in what your bipolar specifically presented as, and your crisis to thrive, and maybe also some of the still challenges at times or not?
Yeah. So the waking up in the psychiatric hospital and being diagnosed with bipolar disorder is awfully scary. And that is my step one, right? That kicked the whole thing off. Now, from the time that I left the psychiatric hospital to the time that I reached recovery, and I define recovery as spending more of my time living my life than I do managing bipolar disorder, that took 4 years. And it took 4 years because of the issues that we've sort of talked about. You've got to find the right medications. You got to find the right combination. You got to be prescribed a medication, wait 6 to 8 weeks and see if it worked. And maybe it needs raised, maybe it needs lowered, maybe it needs added, maybe it doesn't. It took a long time to get not only the medications right, but also in that 4 years, I'm now seeing the world for the first time with this understanding that the things that I thought, believed, and knew are no longer true. So I had to relearn everything. I could no longer count on past assumptions because, well, they were largely colored by untreated bipolar disorder. So I had to learn everything again. I had to understand the world anew. And
can I honor this exact aha moment of perception? What you're talking about, I talk with my patients that when you have depression or ADD or bipolar, I try to work with them. If it's not a life-threatening situation, I go really slow with the med process so that they learn to have their own mindful awareness of their mood state. And who am I now? I'm just going to say that again. Who am I now? And you talk about relearning, but as someone starts to go into their own unique recovery from depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, ADD, PTSD, it's a journey. It's a healing journey. And I think it's really important that clinicians, therapists, and MDs have this dialogue, that we're sort of collaborating and watching and observing together, so that it's not just the meds versus this or the linear, that it's multidimensional. What are your thoughts on that?
You need many, many, many tools to reach recovery. I love this analogy. Could you imagine if you hired a general contractor to work on your house and the individual showed up and he was holding one tool? I don't even care what tool it is. He's holding one tool and he's like, hey, I'm here to fix your house. And you're like, all right, well, where's your toolbox? And he's like, nope, one tool. If I use any other tools, that's offensive and shows that tools don't work. What are you talking about? You don't have multiple tools? Nope. I just have this one tool. This is the best tool. This is the tool that I use. In fact, anybody that uses any different tool is an idiot and a bad person and a sheeple. You would fire that individual so fast. Right. They would be gone immediately. But yet when it comes to our own wellness, we all gravitate toward this one tool. Well, I use medication, or I use therapy, or I use support groups, or I use yoga. Listen, these things are not mutually exclusive. Just like with my handyman example, you can use a saw, a wrench, a screwdriver, needle nose pliers, duct tape. You can have You can have a Phillips screwdriver in 58 different sizes. Nobody cares. I'm fascinated by this idea that it has to be one or the other. It does not.
Yeah, no. We're multidimensional. We are multidimensional beings. And I love that there's also different tools in the toolbox. And I find that there's different seasons. You know, I have people that are on different combinations of meds or light therapy. And so your journey took 4 years of like relearning, getting the right treatment, getting the right team. Does it also include exercise? What are all your current tools in your toolbox for recovery and wellness right now? Whatever you feel comfortable sharing, of course.
Yeah. I mean, it's first and foremost, I'm a person, right? So I never know whether or not to list things like, you know, trying to eat healthy, trying to get good sleep, you know, building a support system, because I never know whether to consider those like bipolar treatment plan or just life, because the reality is I really think that everybody,
yes,
regardless of their mental health state, should go to bed on time, try to eat healthy, get some exercise, drink some water. I don't think that's a bipolar thing. I think that's just a life thing. But it does become more important, I think, for somebody with bipolar disorder. Obviously, if I don't get good sleep, I could push myself into depression or mania.
I was just going to say that sleep.
Yeah.
All my patients, when their sleep starts with, let me be really precise in my words, with specifically bipolar, by the way, the word disorder for me is like nails on the chalkboard, even though I know scientifically we need it because people do feel disordered and there is suffering. But with bipolar neurostyle and then different levels of crisis stabilization and thrive, when people start having sleep issues, that's like a ding, 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 ding. I find that that's one of the hallmark things. And of course, I agree with you. We all need our mental wellness. But I think specifically with bipolar, sleep is one of the hallmark oh no's if that's not on track.
Completely agree. So monitoring those things is super smart in managing bipolar disorder. It is super smart to be aware of those things. And now moving back, I didn't know that on day one. I learned to monitor my physical health and my sleep and eating and breathing and the way my body feels. I learned all of that in therapy. No pill taught me that if I'm not sleeping well, that it could push me into depression or mania and maybe I should look into that, right? Or I should practice better sleep hygiene, or I shouldn't stay up all night. I learned that in therapy. And now let's move into peer support, which is, you know, group therapy. I learned all kinds of things in group therapy. So many things. I'm desperately trying to think of one right now, but you just be sitting there thinking, or I'm sorry, you just be sitting there talking and somebody would say, well, you know, I do XYZ. Hey, that's a really good idea. And then you go incorporate it into your life. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I remember, actually, here's one. I was sitting, you know, I'm older, I'm 45. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder before smartphones. I know. There wasn't even texting yet. So now fast forward, you know, 6-7 years later, not a long time, but later, I do consider myself to be in recovery and stable, and I'm working my way back up, you know, work-wise. I'm working full-time now, and I'm sitting in group, and everybody's talking about how they have no problem taking their night meds because it's just part of their routine to go to bed, right? Mm-hmm. They brush their teeth, they go to the bathroom, they take off their clothes, and they take their pills, and they go to bed. But they're struggling with their morning pills. And a woman in there said, well, I set an alarm clock on my phone. You did what now? My phone, I just set an alarm. When I wake up in the morning, there's this alarm and I don't turn that alarm. Like I'll hit snooze so it's not, you know, beeping in my ear, but I don't clear the announcement until I've taken my pills. So every time I pull out my phone, it's like, oh crap, I got to do that, right? And this helps me. Yeah, us old people, we never thought of that. You know, phones were new, it never occurred to us. We all immediately in the group pulled out our cell phones and started setting alarms for 6 a.m. that said, take pills. It was such a simple thing. And
well, you're also talking about executive function hacks. So, you know, we all, no matter, I love what you said, that whether we have a diagnosis if someone has any diagnoses, ADD, depression, bipolar, but you're talking about good tips and tools. Like, how do you put these good habits into motion? So I love that you found a group of people that were giving you those, like, kind of inspirational, oh, we can do it this way. And then that's what makes it easier, right?
Exactly. And here's the really cool thing, right? I've given tips before. And you say, well, how does that help you? It just feels good. You know what? It feels good to sit in a support group and somebody says, you know, I never remember to take my morning pills and it's a real problem. And I say, well, hey, did you ever think of setting an alarm on your phone? That's a really good idea. You feel like a hero. You just do.
But by the way, I'm picturing a meme where you and I are like, the champion.
Yeah.
So what I also, the three pillars that I talk about with mental health are awareness, self-love, and altruism. And when you're talking about being in a peer group of any type, this altruism, this cooperation, the sharedness of being a human being, you know, it's really important we have a sense of purpose. So, and also when we use a multi-sensory approach of tools to be well, we know they stick when we say it out loud, when we write it down, when we sing it, when we have a moving meditation. So it sounds like this peer group, it's like another, like, it's like almost like layers of tools and texture. And, you know, sometimes it's that fifth time you hear something that you would decide that's your aha moment. You could have heard it four other times, but then you're almost like ready to hear it that day. Can you relate to that?
I can relate to that a lot because it's just like advertising, right? You can't run one ad and expect people to flock to your business, right? You've got to run multiple ads. You've got to permeate their consciousness. You've got to make them remember, and then you've got to remind them when they need it the most. So the reality is maybe the first time to go back to the medication reminder, perhaps the first time I heard that, it wasn't an aha moment because I wasn't taking morning medication. Who knows? Mm-hmm. So therefore, it since it didn't apply to me, it went in one ear and out the other. Or maybe it's advice that I heard. It's like, hey, next time you have a panic attack, you should rub your temples. Well, I can't do that immediately because I'm not having a panic attack in that moment. But I think, hey, that's a good idea. But I don't have another panic attack for a month. And so now it's a month since I heard that advice and I'm having a panic attack. So recall is very, very difficult. Plus it's one piece of advice that I heard over a month ago when I was, and I forgot. So now I go back into the group and I'm like, I had a really, really bad panic attack. And somebody says, hey, did you rub your temples? Oh, you know, I didn't even think about that. So, but now you've got the first time you heard it and you've got a missed opportunity. The missed opportunity sticks in your brain. I missed it.
Yes. And
listen, maybe, especially if you're stubborn like me, maybe you have four panic attacks that you tell the group about and four times they're like, hey, did you rub your temples? And four times you're like, oh, how did I forget? And then that fifth time you have that panic attack, you remember to rub your temples and it works.
Correct.
Now it's burned into your brain because you now have a coping skill for that. And now before you know it, you've been rubbing your temples with a panic attack for 10 years. You don't even know why you do it. It's automatic now.
Yes. But
that's how it started.
Yes.
And that's why I tell people, don't go to one support group and hope for that aha moment. That aha moment is going to come 6 months later, and you're going to have a lot of boring support groups. You're going to have a lot of nothing. You're going to have a lot of this didn't apply to me. You're going to have a lot of sitting in the back and thinking, oh, this was a waste of an hour.
Can I interject with a really kind of important, I know that people also feel this way when they come to me. Like, so usually on the phone, I work on just helping. It's a big deal sometimes to even call a psychiatrist. There's still a lot of stigma. And I'm just thinking of what you're talking about, even in the layers, you know how there's the stages of acceptance, if there's grief or denial, a lot of times people go through a living loss of thinking they have no bipolar or no depression, then how they go through stages of acceptance. So just like it took maybe four panic attacks to finally rub your temples, there's also different stages of awareness. If you get a diagnosis, sometimes you're pissed off and you're angry you have it. So it's like you have to go through that process. And then there's times when people want to just wear the, I'm bipolar. There's other times like, okay, now wait a second. I'm Gabe. I have bipolar. So there's also, I think, really important for us as human beings to respect each other's journey of self-expression, the label that might feel great. Someone's like, no, I want to say bipolar, like loud and strong. Or other people are like, no, I'm this, I have these symptoms. So I just also want to make sure, would you agree that we need to also just be more accepting of each other's journey and the use of language and what feels healthy for us?
I hate the language police. I believe that we all need to describe our journeys in the way that is most authentic and meaningful to us.
Yes. And that's ding, ding, ding. That's the embrace your neuro style. It's like embrace your own neuro style, but then also celebrate others' journey. You know, isn't it? I mean, wouldn't this be a very boring planet if we were all the same?
It would be, well, first off, I'm worried that they would all be me, right? I don't need an entire planet of Gabes, right? I annoy myself. So, oh my, that would be brutal. But yes, it would be incredibly boring, awful, annoying, just whatever word you want to use if we were all the same. And I'm glad we're all different, but we also have to think about just how we describe our own lives. Mm-hmm. There's a saying that I'm really, really fond of. And I say, nobody lies awake at night and wonders if they're having a mental health issue. They lie awake at night and wonder if they're freaking crazy. And the more we start to remove this, especially sick people, you're depressed. You may or may not be suicidal. Maybe you're in the gray area. Maybe you're two stages away. Maybe you're hanging on by a thread, and you're just laying there hating on yourself, and you just, it's brutal. And you have the strength, the courage, the bravery to reach out to somebody and say, I think I'm going nuts. And they look at you and they say, we don't say nuts. We say mental health issue.
Mm-hmm.
That's
no. I think all words matter. So I think all of it matters. I feel like I'm so excited that you and I are just even starting to touch on this. I know we're here at the end, but I agree with what you're saying. But like, even I did a funny asset called mindful profanity, and I have like what's called the fuck button and the bullshit button at my home. But I also have all these other, like, really, you know, I have it all. I've got, you know, my Buddhism, my love, my Christianity, my fuck button, my bullshit. I mean, it's all on the table for me because it's your intentionality and it's how you want to perceive it. And so I think it's really nice when we just allow each other to have our unique perception. And what I was thinking, Gabe, since I was so fortunate to meet you through my interview with Michelle Hammer, and where I know that you, I want to be really respectful of your time. I feel like we're just at this like amazing point in the interview where we're start to do like doing like even more myth busting, and also all the ways, like once someone gets to their recovery after they've found the right person, the treatment, the tools in the toolbox, you and I are right at this crucial myth busting more, and also how to do advocacy and find the right groups for yourself. What if you tell us a little bit about your podcast as well as your book, but then what if I throw it out in the universe to have you and Michelle both on the show? Cause I know you do a podcast together, and we kind of take it further, like from each of your interviews. How does that sound?
I would love to do anything with Michelle. So that is, I am on board. We just need to get Michelle on board. And I feel very confident in saying that Michelle will agree. So okay, I know good. Now I'm speaking for her. She good. Loves it when I speak for good. Her. That's her favorite thing in the whole world.
Oh gosh. Oh boy, I already know you guys are fun. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to laugh. We'll leave it at that. Everyone can interpret my laughter. So, but Gabe, you have so much knowledge, and I know that we're right here at the end of our interview. You and I can do another part two before we meet with Michelle, but can you let everyone know about your podcast, your books, like who you are, how they can get more of you? Cause I want to have like a whole nother show with you right now, but I know it's not realistic. So maybe people can find out where they can find more of you, and then we can have you on again.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much. I accept the invite for a part two, whether I am alone or with Ms. Hammer. And so, yeah, let me tell you all about me. So I wrote the book, Mental Illness is an Asshole and Other Observations. You can get it on Amazon, or you can get it on my website, and I'll sign it and I'll throw in like free stickers and stuff over at GabeHoward.com. Yeah, you get free stickers. I'll sign it. It's awesome. And The book Mental Illness is an Asshole. It's a whole bunch of articles, right? It's observational in nature, one story at a time. And I'm very fond of saying this. There is absolutely something in the book that will make you really happy, and there is absolutely something in the book that will piss you off. And I love that. I really get worried when I read an entire book and I agree with every single thing, because I think, what are the odds, right? Am I being pandered to? Did somebody just do a bunch of research and figure out what just everybody likes and just sort of, you know what I mean? Like, did I learn anything? I mean, sometimes being uncomfortable or seeing something from a perspective different from your own is good. And it's okay to disagree with me. Michelle and I, actually, when we started our podcast a long time ago, we said that we want to make critical thinkers, not fans. Now, we want you to be a fan. We want you to like us, but we're not looking for followers. We're looking to engage people and make them think. And we have people walk up to us all the time and tell us that we're wrong. It's fascinating. You should see our email box. They're just like, well, you suck. And we're just like, okay. All right. Well, we suck. That is just the way of it. What are we going to do? They've told us we suck.
That's a perception. They're allowed to have their perception.
Exactly. And we don't want to fight them on that.
No, because exactly.
If they have decided that we suck, at least they're using critical thinking skills, right?
There you go.
That's really the bottom line. They're absolutely using critical thinking skills if they have decided that we suck. The podcast can be found at thisemotionallife.org/BSP, or just search your podcast player for A Bipolar, A Schizophrenic, and A Podcast. And that, of course, is the one that I do with Michelle Hammer. Now, over on Healthline Media, I do a podcast called This... Oh, sorry. Over on the Healthline Media side, I'm the host of a podcast called Inside Mental Health. It is fantastic. It's had really cool people on the show, from Jillian Michaels to Nikki Sixx from Motley Crue to all kinds of celebrities to doctors, Harvard researchers, people who have been researching mental health and mental health issues for decades, which is really, really super cool and high-end people. And the idea is just to further the mental health, mental illness, and psychology conversation in a way that all of us can relate to and understand. It has some lived experience. It has some research-based. It has some doctors. It has some celebrities. It has people who have gone through the other side with eating disorders. It really is just inside mental health. I really super like the show, and I absolutely recommend that people give it a listen.
I love it. And I just want to let you know that today is actually, for me, it's a gift. You know, the reason why I launched the Dr. Denise brand into the universe was to help change the way we think, talk, and act about mental health. And I have different series that are in alignment, and it's such an honor to spend March 8th, this day, you know, I think Women's International Day, with you, a champion warrior on the front lines of advocacy. So I want to thank you for that. And I'm going to put your bio on the link. And I think with your site, all they can find you everything on your website, correct?
Everything is there. Go to GabeHoward.com and you will learn more about me than you want to.
By the way, I love your speaking reel, and I love that you now love your schnauzer. So,
I love my schnauzer.
What's your schnauzer's name?
Peppy.
And we want to give a shout out to your wife. We can't talk about your schnauzer if we don't say hello to your wife, right?
That's true. Big shout out to the love of my life, Kendall. She is beautiful and fantastic. And I do love her more than the dog, but I understand how people get confused. I do. I hear it. But sincerely, it really is Kendall dog. It's close, but Kendall does edge Peppy out.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, everyone, thank you for listening to this episode with Gabe Howard. We're going to have more of Gabe, and also Gabe, anyway, I can jump on any of your shows. We're kindred spirits. Thank you, everyone. Tune in soon.